want to explain two very difficult parshios in this week's Sedra that are very much misunderstood. And even though if the Torah says something, we don't have to apologize for it, or but if it's misunderstood and the Torah doesn't say it, there's no reason to blame the Torah for something it never said. The first parsha is Sota. People think that the parsha of Sota is the following. A man suspects his wife of committing adultery. Just he has the whim of not trusting her. And then he puts her through a terrible ordeal, right, where she's brought to the Beis HaMikdash and has to drink the water which could kill her, and she has to take a shvua and bring a mincha, and they dishevel her hair and tear her clothing and embarrass her, and either she dies from this process or she's innocent. That seems really really oppressive to this woman. In addition, they say the woman doesn't have the option to do the opposite and accuse her husband of being unfaithful and bring him to this, only the woman. Let's start first with see the difference between men and women when it comes to adultery. A married woman is not allowed to have relations with any other man, and if she does, she is liable to a death penalty. But not only is she liable to the death penalty, so is the man that she lives with. They're equal. She gets a death penalty, and so does the man that she has relations with. So in that respect, they're equal. On the other hand, a married man who has relations with an unmarried woman, because if it's a married woman, so he's chayiv misa because he lived with somebody else's wife. But a married man who lives with an unmarried woman is not chayiv misa. It's not proper. There are other isurim, but it's not a death penalty for sure. Why? Because a man can have more than one wife. So he lives with a woman who's not married. Even though he's married, he could conceivably marry that woman and have more than one wife. So he's not really committing adultery because a man can have more than one wife. What he's doing is living with a woman without marriage. That's a separate prohibition, a much lighter prohibition. Now the question is, why is it like that? Why can a woman only have one husband at a time, whereas a man, from the Torah, can have more than one wife at a time? The answer to that, I mean, the Torah says that. That's the answer. But there's a logical understanding of it. Okay? It may not be the reason, but it's a taste. It makes sense. The Torah wants families that are strong because strong families build Klal Yisrael. And therefore, in order to have a strong family, every child has to know who his father is and his mother is. Because in families where they don't know who their fathers or mothers are, that is not a family. Okay. Therefore, if a woman has more than one husband, then you never know who the father is for sure. This is my mother, and one of these people is my father. That is not a healthy family. But if a man has more than one wife, you always know who the father is. There's only one husband. And you always know who the mother is because she's the one who gave birth to the child. So a man can have more than one wife and there still be a clarity of who is the father and who is the mother. But if a woman has more than one husband, there is never a clarity as to who the husband is. And in a society where there is doubts of who the fathers are, right, in some certain societies, we won't mention where, what, or whatever, Father's Day, they send cards that say to whom it may concern. Oh, those kinds of societies are not very strong societies. So that is a simple, logical understanding of why the Torah prohibited a woman from having more than one husband at a time, and why it permitted a man to have more than one wife at a time. Okay, because of that, if a woman has relations with a man who's not her husband, she is committing adultery. And both she and the man are liable to a death penalty. It's not just her. The man who she lives with is also. But if a man lives with a woman who's not married, but not his wife, he's not committing adultery. He's not a nice guy. He is morally doing something wrong against his wife. But it's not adultery, because conceivably he could have married that woman also. So all he's doing is living with her without marriage, which is a prohibition, but not a death penalty, not as strict a prohibition as adultery. Okay, so that's one thing. Now, therefore, if a man suspects his wife of committing adultery, okay, that does not mean the case of sota is not where a guy wakes up in the morning and he's jealous or he is overly suspicious of his wife, and he puts her through this whole thing because he has his doubts. That's not what happened. Under those circumstances, she would never have to go through this ordeal. What is the case of sota? Where a man sees that his wife is overly friendly with another man, and he is upset about it, and rightfully so. So he warns her in front of witnesses. And he tells her, I don't want you to be alone with that man, which anyway is Aser. He didn't create that Aser. It's called Yichud. A married woman is definitely not allowed to be alone with any man except her husband or her father or her son. But not talking about her father or son. We're talking about another man. And he warns her in front of witnesses, I don't want you to be alone with that man. And again, even if he didn't warn her, she wouldn't be allowed to be alone with anybody, because it's an Isser of Yichud, which is probably from the Torah. But he makes it a point to warn her not to be over the Isser of Yichud. And then, in front of witnesses, she enters a room alone with that guy. She is therefore not exactly the peak of morality. She was warned not to be over an Issa Doraisa of being alone with this guy. She ignored her husband's warning. She ignored the Isser HaTorah of Yichud. And in front of witnesses, she went into a room, but the witnesses weren't there inside the room. They were outside the room. All they know is that she was alone with this guy. They don't know what happened inside that room. She claims they were playing checkers. And the husband suspects maybe that's not the case. Okay. Now, do you think that husband has a right to be suspicious of his wife under those circumstances? Yeah. Is the woman a total tzaddikus? No. She did two things wrong. She ignored her husband's warning, and she was over an Issa Doraisa, which she would have been over anyway, even if he hadn't warned her. So that's called raglayim ledover. There is a basis. There is There's a foundation to be suspicious of her. Now, she claims she's innocent. She didn't commit adultery. Yes, she didn't do something right. She was over an Issa Doraisa of Yichud. She didn't listen to her husband's warning, but that's where it ended. And she is totally innocent of adultery. Now, if she did commit adultery, so if there are witnesses who warned her and saw her commit adultery, literally, okay, they saw, then we kill her and the man that she committed adultery with. If both of them were warned, warning means two witnesses say to them, if you commit this Aveira, you are going to be liable to a death penalty, and this is the death penalty, chenek. And they say, we know, and we don't care, and then they do the Aveira immediately. It's very difficult to have a situation like that where anybody's going to get a death penalty. But that's the only time the woman will get a death penalty. If there were two witnesses who not saw her go into a room with this guy and don't know what happened. But they went into the room too, and they warned them, and they saw them commit the Aveira. That's the only time they'll get a death penalty. That's it. That's not what we're talking about. There is no way that this woman or the man that she lived with could ever get a death penalty because there were no witnesses to the actual Aveira. The only witnesses were that she was alone with this man, and they have no idea what happened in the room. She claims she's innocent, and the husband's not sure. What will be the worst that will happen to this woman if she, in fact, committed adultery? She will have to get divorced from her husband. Her husband will never be allowed to live with her again, and she will not be allowed to live with the man that she committed adultery with ever again. She is usher to both of them. That's the worst that will be. She could marry somebody else and live happily ever after, no problem. She is usher to her husband if she did commit adultery, and she is usher to the person who she lived with. She can even if the husband divorces her, she can never marry that man. Yeah.
Why is she not now in
Mishnah Sotah?
If the witnesses.
Wait, one second. She's not anything yet. She's just right now.
Right now.
Right now, in the situation that we described, she is a doubtful woman, okay? Now, she has a choice, and it's her choice. If she says, I do not want to go through this, what's it called, through this ordeal, okay? And she says, I'm really innocent, but I don't want to go through the ordeal anyway. Or she admits, yes, I committed adultery. Then the only thing that happens to her is we make her husband divorce her, she can never remarry her husband, and she can never marry and live with the man that she committed adultery with. She can go and find another man to marry. She can live happily ever after. That is it. And it's of her choice. If she says, look, you know, I don't want to go through this ordeal, for whatever reason. I'm innocent, but I don't want to go through the ordeal. I'm not innocent, and therefore I don't want to go through the ordeal. Either case, nothing happens to her except she gets divorced and she loses her ksuba and she's usher to her husband forever and usher to the man she lived with. That is it. Nothing more than that. If she says, I am innocent, we really were playing checkers and I'm innocent, and the husband is still not sure, the Torah gave a way for the woman to prove her innocence. That's it. It's not to hurt the woman. It's to give her a chance to prove that she's innocent so her husband will have no qualms and no doubts. Because if she says, I don't want to go through the ordeal, she doesn't go through it. But if she says, I'm innocent and I want to remain married to my husband, but my husband to believe me that I'm innocent. So the Torah gave a way to make shalom between this husband and wife. And the Torah said like this, we put her through this whole ordeal, and she has to swear that she's innocent. She makes a shvua. And she drinks water that has nothing in it that really is dangerous according to nature. It's just water from the kior where the Kohanim wash their hands from. And some dirt from the bottom of the, from the floor of the Mishkan. And into that water, we dissolve the writing of the shvua that she takes. Write it on a parchment. The shvua, the oath that she takes that she is innocent. And if she's not innocent, then she knows that miraculously she's going to die. And we dissolve the Megillah, the ink, into the water with God's name. And from here we learn that God was willing to have his name erased in order to bring peace between a husband and wife. Because that's the purpose of this. The purpose is not to hurt the woman. Because if she's really guilty and she doesn't want to go through this, then she just says, I don't want to go through it. Finished. And all she has to do is get divorced. This only is if she wants to prove her innocence. If she's really guilty and she still goes through it, then part of the reason that she gets killed is not just because she's an adulteress, because she's an apikoris. Because why in the world would you want to go through this if you know that you're guilty because you don't really believe it's going to happen? So then it happens because you're also an apikoris, says the Ibn Ezra. Not just she's an adulteress now. She doesn't believe what the Torah says is going to happen. One second. And therefore, then she goes through this, if she chooses to, and all she has to do is take an oath, bring a korban, a mincha, and then we make it clear that she's not going to take a false oath, because we scare her into understanding what the consequences will be if she's really guilty. And at any point, until they erase God's name, she can say, you know what, I changed my mind. Let's forget about this. I'll get divorced and finished. Once they erase God's name, she doesn't have a choice anymore. Then they force her to drink, and she has to finish the process. But up until that point, she can back out. And we put her through this whole thing in order that she should realize how serious it is, so in case she is really guilty, she'll back out. We don't want her to die. But if she's really innocent, we want to give her the opportunity to prove her innocence, because then she won't die, and then the husband will know that she's 100% innocent. In addition to that, this whole process only works if her husband is not guilty of similar avelers. But if her husband is not so moral, then it doesn't affect her at all. And she could be guilty and get through this without anything happening to her, if her husband is not clean of similar avelers. And in fact, it says that if she dies because of this, somewhere in the world, the man that she lived with also dies at the same time. That's the miracle. So it's not just the woman that's suffering. The man that she lived with also suffers. The only reason we don't put a husband through this is because he's not usher to live with another woman as an adulterer, because he could marry more than one woman. So it's not the same issue, not the same avail. That is the parasha of Sota. It is very different, I'm sure, than you thought it was. Even you young Talmidos Chachamos in Michlala. But I am sure that most of you, at least, were not aware that those are the conditions of the halachas of Sota. Because what's in the world, especially today, where there's a book called Sota, which portrays this in the most gruesome kind of way and makes it look like the Haredi community is so biased against women and do terrible things to women, they may do it. But that's not because the Torah condones it. That's because people are people. People do terrible things. But not because the Torah is something that's biased against women, or God doesn't like women. He created them. So that is the parish of Sota. Any questions on this? Yes.
So we said that if at the beginning the witnesses come in and see that they're committing adultery, they're killed automatically.
Well, not yet, not really. If the witnesses come in and they warn them before they do the Avera, or while they're doing the Avera, before they stop, if you continue doing this Avera, or if you start doing this Avera in front of us, right, then we are going to go to court and testify that you have committed an Avera that is liable to a death penalty. This is the death penalty. And they have to say, we know that, and we don't care, and do the Avera immediately. If they don't do that, or they wait to do the Avera after Toch Kedei Dibur, the time it takes to say Shalom Alecha Rebbe, they don't get the death penalty. No, because nobody can get a death penalty because they admit it with their own admission. The only way you can get a death penalty is if there are two witnesses who saw the Avera, warned you ahead of time, you accepted the warning and did the Avera immediately after.
She's not punished
except by the Rabban Shalom, not by human beings. The only punishment she has is she can't live with her husband anymore. And she can't live with the person that she committed adultery with. That's it. Yeah. Can a woman go through the process more than once if she did this more than once? Yeah. L'chori, yeah. Yeah. If she's innocent and then it happens again, the best of my knowledge, yeah, I don't remember any Gemara that says you can't go more than once. That doesn't mean it doesn't exist, but I don't think so. Yeah.
Even if she's innocent, it's not necessarily like a happily ever after ending. Because
why?
She still didn't have Avera. And
she didn't have Avera that, according to her, she was over in Isra of Yichud. Okay. She's not the biggest tzaddikus in the world. She did tshuva. She went through this ordeal. She probably would never do it again. And she's convinced her husband, the Torah's convinced her husband, that she's innocent. And now the husband will not have suspicions about her. Because if a husband constantly is suspicious of his wife, what kind of shalom bayis could there be? But the Torah gave a way for the husband to be convinced that she's really innocent. And now he'll... So the worst that she did is she was alone with somebody he warned her not to be, and they played checkers together. Okay, that the husband's not going to hold that against her for the rest of her life. That she blessed with, right. Not only is she not harmed, but she will benefit. If she didn't have children, she'll be able to have children. If she, had children, but she had difficult pregnancies, she'll have easy pregnancies. If she had boys, she'll have girls. If she had girls, she'll have boys, and so on.
But why would she get all this if she put herself in a bad situation? She did something wrong.
Because there's something called b'makom shebalei tshuva omdim afilu tzadikim gemurim einamich. If she went through this whole ordeal and she's really innocent and she did the minor avera, we're sure that she did tshuva. If she did tshuva, she gets a schus. Yeah.
Why would anyone go marry her even if she admits why they're dope, and all she has to do now is divorce and get married? Who would ever marry someone though after a community such a thing?
Some man who is as bad as she is. There are a lot of bad men in this world who are looking for women just like that.
Yeah.
Did it ever happen? From the Gemara, there are Maisim of Salt. It did happen. Yeah.
Is it possible for a woman to put herself in a position on purpose so that way she can have a kid?
It's a big machlokus. There's a Gemara in Brachos. Are you asking it just like this, or you know that there's... The Gemara says that Chana, when she davened for a child, she said to the Rabbanu Shel Olam the following: if you grant me a child, fine. If not, I'm going to go and put myself into this situation of being a sota. Obviously, I'm going to be innocent. I'm going to make my husband put me through the ordeal, and because I'm innocent, I'll have a child. The Gemara says, the Mefarshim say, it's not really, she could go be over in Issur D'oraisa of being alone with a man she's not allowed to be alone with. But the Gemara, there are Mefarshim who say that even if the Hasra was with her father, the husband said, I don't like the way that you are alone with your father. I don't want you, you're allowed to be yichud with your father, but here the husband says, I suspect that this is not a healthy situation, okay? So he gave her hasra not to be alone with her father. She's allowed to be alone with her father. So she's only being over her husband's warning. That kind of case could be she's not over any issue, really. So, but most Mefarshim say over there, she didn't really mean it. She just was saying, Rabbanu Shalom, look how desperate I am. So please give me a child. I'm so desperate, and if I could, I would do this too. That's more logical what the Gemara means. Yeah.
Besides the two, but after for the man he committed adultery with also, I don't really see how that would make an effect. He was with him when it was after before. He'll be with him again now.
Because basically she's a frum woman. She just has a Yetzer Hara and she did something wrong. And therefore, if you tell her, living with this man on an ongoing basis, you're going to be over an Isser every time you live with him, right? It may make a difference to him. Okay, we're not talking about people who don't believe in anything or people who are mufkarim. We're talking about nice, frum people who do averas. Unfortunately, that is a fact, that frum people also do averas. But we can't assume that they're going to continue doing averas. And besides the fact, there's another answer too. And that is, we don't let her marry him. And we We have, you know, policemen. At the time when Beis Din had the power, just like there are policemen who don't let you steal and don't let you murder, there were policemen who didn't let you commit other aveiros also. But you don't have to come on to that. Just regular people. If we tell her, you know, you're usher to her, whatever. I mean, I had a situation where, can I tell you this? I don't know. Yeah, why not? You're not little kids. You had enough things in school that they skipped because whatever. You're not holding by that anymore. I had somebody once ask me a shaila like this. A woman came to me. It wasn't about her. It was about her sister. And it really was, not that she was asking about her sister. Her sister lived in a different community, different state in America. And it was a very not nice situation where two families who were friendly with each other, best of friends, the husband and wife and the other husband and wife, the husband of one family committed adultery with the wife of the other family and destroyed two families. And this man said that he was going to divorce his wife, and he wanted this woman to get divorced from her husband, and they would get married. They would get married. And in the end, the husband of the wife divorced her, so she was divorced. And he believed her that she committed adultery. He couldn't live with her anymore, so he divorced her. The husband who committed adultery, in the end, didn't divorce his wife. He decides, and his wife forgave him. So his family was okay, and this poor woman was not here, not there. She had destroyed herself with her family, and now this guy who committed the Averu didn't want to marry her. Okay. That's what happened in the end. However, the Rav of the community told her, there's no way in the world that even if he divorces his wife that you can marry him. Because since you committed adultery with him and you admit it, and he admits it, there's no way you could ever live together. So he told him. It's awesome. These were people who were Shomer Shabbos people. I mean, from people. So the Rav wouldn't permit them to get married. And it was known in the community, so there was no way they could get married. And no way that they would get married if they knew it was usher. So what was the shaila? The shaila was, the sister came to me and said, look, this is the fact. We're not going to make anything any better. She did a terrible thing, right? But the truth is, there is a possibility that she was never really married. Because the marriage was done by a conservative rabbi, and there were no kosher witnesses to her marriage, original marriage. And therefore, really, she was living with this guy and had children, but she never really was a married woman. All this was done, she wasn't married, because there was never really a valid kedushin, because there never were really any kosher witnesses. And they took all the chasna pictures of the original marriage, and there was nobody there from that could have except relatives that could have possibly been a kosher witness, and without witnesses, there is no marriage. So she never was really married to her first husband. If she wasn't married, she couldn't have committed adultery. So when she lived with the other guy, she really wasn't committing adultery because she wasn't married. What? Her children, an unmarried woman who has children, the children are 100% kosher. They're not mamzerim. A mamzer is not what the world calls a mamzer. A mamzer is the product of a married woman living with somebody else having a child, or incest. A woman living with her brother or her father or somebody she's chayv mis or chayv koris for. But a stama, an unmarried woman having a child, the child is 100% kosher. So the children were kosher no matter what. If she was married, they were kosher. If she wasn't married, they were kosher. So it wasn't a problem with the children. The only question was, did she commit adultery? Was she really a married woman or not? And if she wasn't a married woman, then she just wasn't usher to her husband, but he divorced her. So theoretically, he could remarry her if he wanted to, but he wasn't interested. But she wasn't usher to the man she lived with because she never committed adultery with him. Looking into it, I wrote to Moshe Feinstein at the time, gave him all the details, and he wrote back that she's mutter to marry the guy. In the end, the guy didn't want to marry her and didn't want to divorce his wife. So she ended up suffering on both sides, and I ended up being very, very in bad straits with the rabbi of that community, who was very friendly with these families and really thought this woman did a terrible thing and did not want her to be able to benefit from it. And who in the world are you from another community to write to Rabbi Moshe Feinstein and say that this woman could get married? So in any case, I think that rabbi forgave me after a time, but I learned a lesson from that also. In any case, so that's an interesting case. Okay. But you ask who would want to marry such a person? There are plenty of people who would want to marry such a person. Okay. Yeah.
That what? Was it done in private, drinking the water?
Oh, no. It was not done in private. It was done in the Beis HaMikdash, and it was done in front of people for two reasons. One is to embarrass the woman, to make sure that if she really was guilty, she would back out before. We don't want her to die. So we wanted her to get scared, and if she really thought that, nothing's going to happen to me, after this ordeal, if she really was guilty, she'd back out before it wasn't possible. And secondly, in order to make an impression that, again, even if she only played checkers, she still was not the epitome of morality. Her husband warned her not to be alone with this guy. She was alone with him in Issur D'oraisa. And we want other women and men to realize that this is not the proper conduct. So they were brought to see what she's put through, even if she's innocent, from what she did, and people will know not to do such things. So for those two reasons, we did it publicly and in a way that really embarrassed her, right? And that was part of her kapara, too. Okay. And, yeah. Yeah, she's not chayim misa b'dei shamayim does not mean she'll die in this world. Could be she'll get kares in the next world and something affect her neshama. Could be she'll die before she's 60. Won't be an immediate kind of thing.
Isn't it better to just die in this world than to have forever?
Yes, but she can also do tshuva too. Tshuva would not take away the death penalty if she was liable to a death penalty. If she's not liable to a death penalty, you can square her away with the Rabbanu Shlom. You can do tshuva for a koresh too and get the koresh taken off. Okay. Is it much clearer now to you what this parsha is about? And is, in fact, was it not so well understood before we did this? Okay. So now, in case anybody ever brings this parsha up as a proof of how terrible the Torah treats women, you'll know that it is kimat the opposite. Kimat. Okay. Next parsha. Nazir. A Nazir, it says that there's a connection. If somebody sees what wine can do to somebody, because usually by getting drunk, that's what leads people to do these averas. So Yazir atzmo min hayayin. He should make a vow that he becomes a Nazir and won't drink wine. A Nazir is called Kodesh. He's holy because he separated himself from wine. He's a holy person. Yet in another part, the Torah says that he brings a Korban Chatas, a sin offering, and the Gemara says, what sin did he do? Shetzir Asma Min Hayayim, that he separated himself and suffered by not drinking wine. So it seems to be a little bit of a contradiction. On the one hand, right, we say this person's a holy person because he separated himself from wine. Right? He is practicing precious separation from the physical things of the world. He's a holy person. At the same time, he's a sinner for the same reason. So which is it? Is he a sinner or is he holy? Is it a positive thing to separate yourself from the physical pleasures of this world? or is it a negative thing? How can it be both? So one answer, there are other answers, but one answer which really gives over the hashkafa of Yiddishkeit is that the ideal is what HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants you to do is to be involved in the physical things of this world. Not to be dependent on them, like we explained in the past, but to use them and elevate them and sublimate them to spiritual purposes. Torah wants you to eat and to drink and to enjoy everything in this world, not to be dragged down into materialism, but to elevate everything in the world and use it for the right purpose. HaKadosh Baruch Hu didn't create a world that people should run away from it. And therefore the Yerushalmi says that La'asid Lavo, a person is going to have to give an accounting for everything he could have enjoyed in this world and didn't. There is a mitzvah to be involved in the world, not to separate yourself from the world. But if a person knows that being involved in a physical thing in this world is going to drag him down and make him do things that are wrong, then it is positive for him to separate himself. Meaning the following. The ideal is indulgence. Indulging, using the world properly. That's the ideal. Not separating yourself from the world. But if you know that indulgence is going to lead you to something wrong, then, b'di'evid, it's better to separate yourself than to do what's wrong. That is the Jewish hashkafa on materialism. It is ideal to be involved with all the material, physical things of the world. But if you know that doing that is going to lead you to negative things, then it's preferable to abstain rather than sin. That is the antithesis, the opposite of Christian theology. The Christians in the New Testament say the following. It is better to abstain from getting married. It's better to be a priest, a nun, and at least ostensibly look like you are totally abstaining from the physical pleasures of this world of marriage. However, it's better to marry than to burn. Meaning, if you know that you can't control your desires by abstaining, and you're going to be led to do things wrong, then, b'di'evid, it's better to indulge in a permissible way than to come to do something usur by abstaining. It's the exact opposite of the Torah. Torah says it's ideal to indulge the proper way. But if you know that indulgence is going to bring you to sin, then, b'di'evid, it's better to abstain than to sin. Christianity says just the opposite. Just the opposite. So therefore, we can understand the Nazir. Really, a person should drink wine and use it for mitzvahs, kedusha, right? A person can drink wine and use it for a host of mitzvahs, a host of kedusha. But if you know that drinking wine is going to put your defense system at a low point, and you may end up doing things that are wrong, then it's better to abstain from drinking wine than to drink wine and use it the wrong way. But the ideal is use it the right way. Therefore, a nazir on the one hand is a chote. Chote means he's missing something. Chet means chisaron. He's not at the ideal because he should be able to drink the wine and use it for positive purposes. But he's also a kodesh because he recognizes his limitations, and he knows that if he drinks the wine, it's going to bring him to negative things, so it's better to abstain. So on the one hand, he's kodesh. On the other hand, he's not at the ideal. The ideal would be to drink the wine and use it properly. Yeah. That? Less gashmius? Okay, that's another aspect of this. Since you mentioned it, I'll mention it. There is nothing intrinsically a mila of abstaining from gashmias that you could use and need for your avodas Hashem. But if you don't need that gashmias, there's a mila to outgrow it and not need it, and not be dependent on that for your avodas Hashem. That could be a mila. In other words, the following. If you're a six-year-old girl and you have your favorite doll and your mother takes the doll away from you, it is going to be traumatic. You're going to cry. You lost your favorite doll. But if you're your age and your mother takes away that doll, hopefully, right, it is not going to be that traumatic. Big deal. You outgrew it. You don't need that doll anymore. Okay? As long as you need the gashmias to aid in your avodas Hashem, okay? I need an ice cream cone every once in a while, right? Because it gives me a feeling of good feeling, and because of that, I feel better about myself, and I can do more chesed, and I can learn better, whatever. Okay, that's not really, that's not exactly where I'm holding. But in any case, but let's say that person would say that, okay? So, okay, fine. Then you shouldn't abstain from that ice cream cone, because you can use it in a very positive way. And if you abstain from it, you are hurting yourself for no purpose. Unless you know that if you eat that ice cream cone, you're going to end up eating things that are usher, then better not eat the ice cream cone. But you can outgrow the need for the ice cream cone. I don't need that. I can do my same avodas Hashem without it because I've outgrown it. I don't need it. What? Should you aim for that? Yeah, a person should aim not to be dependent on physical things and only use them because he's using them, not because he needs them, but because he can utilize them in service of the Rabbanu Shalom. It's a much higher level. That you're dependent on, yeah. But if you're on a level where you don't need the gashmias, but you are now using it, then it becomes like using it for a korban, or whatever, and your eating and drinking becomes like a korban. That's a much higher level. That's a level of kedusha, which is where you utilize gashmias, not that you use it because you enjoy it or you need it, but you're using it because that gashmias is the same thing you use for avodas Hashem. That's a much higher level. But if you're not on that level, then yeah, ideally maybe you shouldn't be dependent on gashmias. If you still are, then the ideal is to use it properly, not to abstain, unless you know that if you don't abstain, right, but as long as, and that's what some people say, the problem with the Nazir is shetzir atzmo min hayayin. He obviously still needed it, because he went back to drinking it. If he didn't need it, he never would have gone back to drinking it. He became not a Nazir. That's when he has to bring the Korban Chatas. Okay. Yeah. You have to be on a very high level to know that, or you have to have somebody that knows you well, that's guiding you, that can differentiate for yourself. On our level, we can't differentiate between that, and therefore, for the most part, it's not a positive thing unless you know that you are going to use those physical things the wrong way, not to abstain from them. To use them properly, yeah. No. The thing is like this. On the one hand, he's doing the right thing, but it's not the ideal. Sin over here means there's something missing. Okay? It's the proper thing to do, but it's not the ideal. Tosus compares it to the following. If a person has a bad dream on Shabbos, then he's allowed to fast on Shabbos, but to make up for fasting on Shabbos, he has to fast on Sunday to make up for fasting on Shabbos. It's the right thing to do, but it would be better if you hadn't had to do that. So there's something missing that you have to atone for, but this is the proper thing to do. It's proper to abstain, but you should have been on a higher level where you wouldn't have had to do that. Yeah.
Why is Hashem punishing him for anything?
He's not punishing. He's bringing a chatas to make up for that which is less than the ideal, that which he's missing. He didn't do anything wrong. He just missed something that needs to be compensated for.
Hashem told him to do it.
Yeah, only because he's on a level that he needs that. But had he been on a higher level, Hashem would have told him to do something else. Okay, we have a few minutes left. I just want to say goodbye to you. I really enjoyed teaching you this year. You were very, very interested Talmidos. I can tell usually from your eyes, especially if they're open. And questions and the reactions, I really enjoy teaching you, and I would like to hear the Besuros Tovos that will come, each one in their proper time, as you now go to other levels of your life, Mirtz Hashem. Don't come to me in 5 years when you meet me in New York or somewhere else and say, I was in Michlala 5 years ago, remember my name? Because I don't know your name now. And it would be a nace galui if I would remember your name then and I didn't know what to begin with. Okay? Maybe it's a chisaron that I don't know your name, but I come only once a week and I teach about 1,000 talmidim a week, so it's very hard to get to know everybody's names. I probably will remember your face, unless by that time I am so senile that I don't remember anything. But if not, then I will remember your face. And I'd like you to come over. And I definitely will remember that you were a Talmida. And I'd like to hear the Suros Tovos. I wish all of you tremendous Hatzlacha. And Mirtz Hashem, the Rabbanu Shem should give you a very, very happy and fulfillment in life, successful lives, in every stage that you're going, Mirtz Hashem, getting married and having children and building a home and a career, perhaps, whatever it may be, should be matzliach. And Mirtz Hashem, we should meet on happy occasions. And Mirtz Hashem, if you remember some of the things that I taught you, that'll be a big schus for me too, which I could use every schus I can get. So I appreciate it. Okay. Hatzlacha Rabbah.